Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Good evening, everyone. If you enjoy our show and find our research both interesting and informative, please can I ask that you consider leaving us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does help us out a huge amount. You can also find out more about us and our work by heading over to deadsouls.co.uk and checking us out. We are a small team of 3 researchers with more than 70 years of experience between us. You can also find us and speak to us over on Instagram. Just search Dead Souls Social Club and we'll come up. So, as always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is Lobotomy. I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. In November of 1941, a 23-year-old woman was wheeled into an operating theatre at George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences. She had a long history of mental illness, and it had become difficult for her family to manage. So they opted to undergo, or rather inflict upon their family member, a brand new procedure that was said at the time to cure personality disorders and revolutionise mental health treatment. When she was in the operating theatre, doctors James W. Watts and Walter Freeman strapped her to the table and they took out a large, long and thin metallic instrument and inserted it into the patient's eye socket. The young woman being operated on was Rosemary Kennedy, the younger sister of future US President John F. Kennedy. Sadly, the surgery was not a success. Rosemary's specific diagnosis wasn't entirely clear. It still isn't. And that's because the Kennedy family, specifically Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., did everything he could to hide her condition from the public. Such was the stigma of mental health issues at the time. The situation was only exacerbated by the family being in the public eye at the time and perceived by many as being, quote, America's first family, or the closest thing to American royalty, unquote. But by all accounts, she was significantly mentally challenged. And, as she entered her early 20s, she allegedly became more irritable, difficult to control, and sometimes physically violent. She was initially sent to a convent in Washington, D.C., in the hope that it would calm her. But the nuns at the convent would state that Rose would sneak out at night, and there were rumors that she was sexually promiscuous. Rose was seemingly behaving in ways that were embarrassing for one of the most powerful political families in the world. By today's standards, this all seems far from mental illness, or the behaviors of someone who is mentally unwell. But times were very different in the 1940s. Very different. The procedure performed on Rose was a prefrontal lobotomy. It was a surgery that was about as terrifying as they come, but at the time it was hailed as a huge leap forward in the treatment of mental illness. Bear in mind that this was before any kind of psychiatric drugs or cognitive therapy, such as we now have. In fact, the prefrontal lobotomy won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1949. It must be great, right? Well, not necessarily. Within just a decade of winning the highest acclaim in medicine, the procedure was considered barbaric and eventually slowed to a trickle in the United States. Lobotomies and all other psychosurgeries were banned in the UK by 1983. Whilst they are still legal in the United States, they are now extremely rare. But why? Well, partly because of people like Rose Kennedy. Because Rose's condition didn't improve after the lobotomy. Quite the opposite, in fact. Rose was permanently incapacitated, unable to walk, unable to speak, and incontinent for the rest of her life. She died in January 2005 at the age of 86. Rose, of course, was far from the only person to receive this procedure. But what exactly is a lobotomy? Well, it's a procedure that is about as simple as it is brutal. A patient is sedated with general anesthesia, and then a doctor takes what is essentially an ice pick, or to be exact, an instrument called an orbitoclast. The doctor inserts the orbitoclast, for all intents and purposes, a long metal spike, into the corner of the patient's eye, just slightly above the tear duct, and then taps it with a metal mallet. The mallet taps the spike and drives it in the corner of the eye, piercing the thin bone that separates the eye socket from the brain's frontal lobe. The spike enters the frontal lobe and is maneuvered back and forth to sever the connections to and from the prefrontal cortex, the anterior part of the frontal lobes. The procedure in its description sounds entirely simplistic and primitive. And it was. Really. Doctors Freeman and Watts eventually could perform this procedure in full in less than 10 minutes. Staggering considering its life-impacting outcome. The surgery was thought by some at the time to cure severe mental illnesses. And to support that, there were several types of lobotomies too, which were also referred to as leucotomies. The procedure I just described is called a transorbital lobotomy, if you want to get technical. Called that as it goes through the orbit of the eye socket. Also commonly performed in the 1940s and 50s were transcranial lobotomies. The procedure of these types of surgery would enter through the top of the skull. Naturally, the operation required drilling through the thicker part of the skull bone and was a more significant procedure to undergo. A syringe-like tool called a leucotome would then pierce the brain, after which the same motion would be performed inside the brain with a little wire loop, or by injecting a scolarosing agent to harden the brain fibers. The ultimate goal of all these procedures, though, was to disrupt the prefrontal cortex of the brain. As such, because of this, they're often called prefrontal lobotomies or prefrontal leucotomies. Given that the human brain tissue has the feel and consistency almost of jelly, it's not too difficult to think of this procedure as a stirring of the mind, quite literally. Now, I'm fully aware that all this sounds grotesque and pretty insane, but there was a reason why this was so popular for a short while. It's because the alternative was so much more worse. Far, far worse. There is a stigma around mental illness currently, sure, but there always has been. Perhaps more so in previous decades. I would be entirely confident in arguing, in fact, that back in the 1940s and 50s, the perception of mental health issues was much, much worse than we perceive it to be today. I mean, we didn't really understand how the brain worked. And by we, I mean the collective we, society, the medical community, science. Almost nothing was known about the human brain nor understood about mental health conditions. We, in all honesty, barely knew how the body worked at the start of the last century, but the brain in particular, well, people thought your emotions and your personality came from your soul. So, if you were having issues in that department, it was considered an ailment of the soul. It was an entirely spiritual thing, a religious thing. Organized religion really has a lot of explaining to do. But because of this, most people back then thought that mental illness was some kind of divine punishment or demonic possession, which came with just some really lovely and not at all surprising treatments. The first treatment in this field actually is one of the very first surgeries that we have evidence for, and that was for trepanation. Trepanation is quite simply drilling a hole into someone's head to let the demons out. To physically drain demonic entities from the human head. It is thought that folks might have this procedure carried out for mental health reasons, attributing to a demonic possession or even something like common headaches and migraines. In fact, skulls with holes drilled into them go back some 7,000 years, with evidence of the procedure being conducted across cultures and in several parts of the world. In a lot of these skulls, the hole had even healed over, essentially evidencing that the owner of said skull had survived this procedure. Thousands of years before antiseptics, anesthesia, or any sort of modern medication, the holes were roughly the size of a quarter or 10 pence piece, so not even a small incision. In the late Middle Ages, bloodletting and purging were often used to treat mental illness, along with a litany of other conditions. This will come as no surprise because they treated pretty much everything that way. The current thinking at the time blamed a huge amount of conditions on what they called an imbalance in the humours. There were four humours. The four humours being blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. This thought process actually dated back to the ancient Greek era, though it lasted in place until the 1700s. It was an English physician named Thomas Willis that would make the connection between the humours and mental illness. While it may sound absurd by current standards, it was considered pretty groundbreaking at the time. To blame a person's emotions and behaviours on a physical issue and not demonic possession was considered incredibly enlightened. So all that draining of blood, torture, and forcing people to vomit up literal stomach bile was replaced with something much more humane. In the 17th century, we begin to see a proliferation of asylums for the mentally ill in an effort to kind of take them out of society and sweep them under the rug. I guess that old adage that if you can't see something, that it's not a problem, took hold. Asylums were also justified as a place that would be best for the mentally ill, because at the time, isolation was a popular method of treatment. Society considered it a safer environment for the mentally ill to live in, and they wouldn't have to have the weight of society on their shoulders, an actual quote from a doctor at the time. But in contrast, the following statement was also true and observed. Quote, "One can hardly imagine a human being in a more degraded and brutalized condition than that in which I found this person." Unquote. This was said by Anna Stone, who found a patient naked, filthy, and chained with several others against the wall of a damp, dark stone cell at Bethlehem Royal Hospital in London, known more commonly as Bedlam. It's worth noting that while I refer to persons with mental health illnesses here, at the time period we are talking about, patients at the asylums were commonly described as lunatics, imbeciles, insane, idiots, or cretins, all words which are considered insults by today's standards. Within those asylums, popular treatment was called the Bath of Surprise, which was common practice in many asylum institutions. It actually emerged as a treatment in the 1700s and involved the sedation of a patient and then the rapid dunking of them into a tank of ice-cold water with no warning and at complete surprise to the patient. Some asylums, which didn't have the facilities to perform this treatment, instead opted to perform a simpler version with the tools that were readily available to them. This essentially meant that they would sedate a patient, then throw them into the middle of an icy lake from a boat and let them swim back to the shore themselves. And yes, as they were sedated, a lot didn't make it. It's where the saying sink or swim came from. Over time, this treatment eventually evolved into a treatment of, for lack of a better phrase, surprise or unsuspecting ice douching of a restrained patient. It caused heartburn and a desire to urgently vomit, both thought to help cure the patient. It also subdued the patient and was used to calm raging excitement and reduce their sex drive, thus forcing them to be more obedient to those in charge, it was stated. Again, this was before any of the pharmaceutical medications that we have today that can calm a patient who is in distress. So it turns out that a huge dunk in a big old bathtub can shock a person into calming down, apparently. I'm sure there's many people out there who are part of the current ice bath cult that might actually agree with this. And there is science to say that it does actually release dopamine in quick bursts, and it calms you down, pretty much shocking your central nervous system. So there is some legitimacy behind it. Although it's a very empty measure, the effects lasting only minutes. Eventually this treatment, which involved ice water, later developed into what was called hydrotherapy, where the patient is kind of strapped into a tub for hours or even days on end with continuous cold water pumped into it. Sounds more like hypothermia therapy to me. As the 19th century and the Victorian age came around, institutionalized care was intensified, with asylums and mental hospitals springing up all across the United States, UK and Europe. And at this point, they were basically just confinement and isolation from society, which was essentially their prime directive. At its peak in the 1940s and 50s, there were 100 asylums in the UK and more than 170 in the United States, with 555,000 inpatients stateside and around 150,000 in England and Wales. This equals to around 0.3 of the population on both sides of the Atlantic by population volumes at the time. These asylums were overcrowded and many of the patients were physically violent, so they were mostly just concerned with protecting the staff. This is where and why straitjackets were developed and introduced. Patients were often chained to walls and put in cages, and I don't mean jail cells, I mean tiny cramped cages the size of similar to what we would consider inappropriate for an animal today, with the patient being locked up for hours, even days at a time. Patients were subjected to a number of wacky treatments, such as the rotating chair, which was a chair that patients were strapped into and just spun them around until they threw up and speedily emptied their bladder and bowels, which isn't all that different a process to purging of the four humours in medieval times. So, the current available treatment at the time was in fact way behind the times, centuries behind in fact. Physicians would sedate the patients with drugs, this element being arguably quite advanced, though these were very rudimentary drugs and dosage control was often not a thing, and more often than not, the drug just incapacitated the patient altogether. The worst part of all was that many of the people who found themselves in these asylums were committed for fairly mundane things like epilepsy and common melancholy. Even simple willfulness was considered committable. To be clear, willfulness is the quality of a human determined to do what you want even when it goes against reason, arguments, or persuasion. Some now call it stubbornness. Imagine being committed to a Victorian-era asylum for simply being determined to follow your own path. Women were also especially and unfairly targeted for committal. Of course they were, because in our shared history, that train is never late. In the sad reality of this time, if women didn't obey their husbands or didn't abide by the crushing social norms expected of them, then they could be labelled hysterical and committed to an asylum. Unfortunately for many, asylums were regarded as prisons disguised as hospitals. It was a convenient way to remove the poor and incurable from society, and for those with money, private madhouses were often convenient dumping grounds for unwanted wives. Women at the time were expected to be demure, polite, and agreeable to the men in their lives. Should a woman dare to speak out of turn or argue with her father or husband, however, she could be considered hysterical and in need of treatment. Although many patients were admitted for short periods of time, there are plenty of stories of patients who were admitted to asylums, often for very unsatisfactory reasons and basically forgotten about. Some could spend 20 or more years locked away, and sadly some patients died without ever being released. I have added an image to our Instagram that shows the various reasons that an individual in the 19th century could be committed to the asylum. The image is from the admittance book of the Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum in West Virginia, though the admittance reasons were essentially industry standard at the time. I think it's safe to say that neurodiversity was not as celebrated as we have come to know it back then. Many of the people who entered the asylum system might have had a few quirks or unique traits when they first went into the hospital, and I'm using the term hospital fairly loosely here. But after 6 months or a year in that environment, they would very often actually develop real and significant mental health issues, which would only extend their stay and lead to further overcrowding of the system. The asylum system was meant to provide exactly that, asylum. It was meant to be a respite from the world for those who needed it the most. A rest and recuperation period from all that was causing those to be afflicted. In a high number of cases, however, it usually just made things far worse. Luckily, and for the good of human suffering, whilst this was playing out, there were advancements being made in the field of brain science, and our understanding of the human brain was increasing. This was due in part to some lucky accidents, such as like one that happened in Vermont in the 1840s. On the 13th of September 1848, a railroad worker named Phineas Gage was placing explosive powder as part of his job role, when the powder ignited and blew the rail tamping rod through the bottom of his face. His cheek, to be precise, right next to his mouth. The rod travelled at high velocity through his head and exited out of the top of his cranium. And, somehow, he survived. The Phineas Gage story has been told a million times over, and it's a well-known tale. It's both remarkable and gruesome in equal measure, and just wild that this guy survived a metre-long iron rod being fired through his head. Just imagine how he removed it. But survive he did. He did not survive completely unscathed, however. Gage's personality changed drastically. Prior to the accident, he was amiable, well-balanced, and a positive employee. He got along and was friendly with everybody. After the accident, he became difficult to deal with, easily irritable, angry, and impatient. He cursed people out a lot, which he never did before. He became angry, negative, and foul-mouthed. He also developed severe epilepsy, which eventually became his cause of death 13 years later. But it was his change in personality that got the attention of the psychiatric community. This was the first time the damage to a specific part of the brain could be linked to personality issues, especially emotional regulation. It actually started a whole field of study around figuring out which parts of the brain controlled what. The motor cortex. You see, there was a language and speech processing area, visual processing area, long-term memory, short-term memory areas. Scientists figured out that the brain had evolved from the rear to the front side. So taking the rear of the brain into account, at its base, where the controls or functionality sits for your core functions, your breathing, your digestion, your body temperature regulation, even your blinking, then as you continue forward towards the frontal section of your brain, its functionality involves more complex and advanced processing. The prefrontal cortex, which handles your personality, your judgment, your emotional regulation, higher core operations, so to speak. It's why Phineas was able to survive this blast. The rod didn't go through the back of the brain. If it had gone through the back of the brain, he would have been killed instantly. He was considered lucky to have the rods enter only through the prefrontal cortex. So over the next century, more attention had been paid to other so-called lucky accidents that helped refine science's understanding of the brain and its structures. That, along with some animal experimentation that was being done, and actual attempted brain surgery, but still very much in its infancy. This all came to a head at the Second International Congress of Neurology in 1935. It was this conference that would change the landscape of psychology and neurology, leaving ultimately thousands of people in vegetative states. It was held at the University College of London on July 29th to August 2nd, 1935. While epilepsy was the main theme of the conference, it was actually a handful of presentations regarding the frontal lobes that essentially stole the show. A French neurosurgeon by the name of Clovis Vincent, with a paper he had written titled, quote, "Modification of function observed after surgical intervention on the frontal lobes," a catchy title, and neurologist Richard Brickner from the New York Neurological Institute, who talked about a surgery which he called a bilateral frontal lobectomy that was performed by Johns Hopkins University to remove a brain tumor. In addition, a Yale neuropsychologist named John Fulton presented a study called, quote, "The Functions of the Frontal Lobes, a Comparative Study in Monkeys, Chimpanzees, and Man," unquote. The study reported a couple of chimpanzees that received lobectomies, and they demonstrated how they had a noticeable change in personality, specifically having fewer, so described, temper tantrums and experimental neuroses. Through all of this, an idea began to form. That being, in the brain, the actual processing mostly occurs on the outside of the wrinkled surface. There is more surface area to do more processing. But inside the brain, there's, in layman's terms, bundles of fibers which are called white matter. The white matter basically moves signals around to other parts of the brain. You can think of it like the cables coming out the back of a rack of servers. In a sense, like each server is in a different module, and the cables allow those different modules to communicate with each other, in a sort of organic computer network. These studies with chimpanzees were showing that removing parts of the frontal lobe can make the animal more complacent. But the huge factor here is that it's a major and very risky surgery. So, spitballing, maybe instead of removing that part of the brain, the frontal lobe, what if all you had to do was just cut some of the white matter cables so the brain can't communicate as effectively anymore? This idea actually resonated strongly with another attendee of the conference, a Portuguese neurologist named Antonio Igaz Moniz. Several months after attending the conference, Moniz and his assistant Pedro Lima performed the first leucotomy on a human. It involved going in through the skull with a leucotome tool to sever the white matter fibers. White matter fibers which were connecting the prefrontal cortex. Although in this first surgery, he also injected alcohol into the brain to destroy the frontal lobe completely, for reasons best known to himself. Moniz would refine this procedure over the years, of course, but his work was cut short in 1939 when a schizophrenic patient shot him several times in his office. Moniz did survive the attack, but he was left paralyzed for the rest of his life. He did continue his neurology practice until his death in 1955, however. Because Moniz was gunned down by a patient, this only highlighted the fact, or at least the perception, that some people with mental illness were dangerous to the wider society. Thus, ultimately, only justified the surgery he pioneered even more. At least to him and his supporters anyway. The fact that the procedure he pioneered permanently resulted far more often than not in total mental incapacitation was neither here nor there, it seemed. And nobody picked up this cause and ran with it more than a US doctor named Walter Freeman, the doctor we mentioned at the start of this episode. Freeman was also at the Second International Congress of Neurology, and he met Moniz there. Moniz actually became a bit of a mentor for him. Walter Freeman modified Moniz's procedure, calling his version a lobotomy, and which is why the US and UK refer to the procedure differently to our friends in Europe, even though it's the exact same procedure, essentially. Freeman did his first lobotomy in 1936 on a woman named Alice Hood Hammett, a 63-year-old housewife from Topeka in Kansas. It did not go well. Hammett suffered debilitating convulsions in the weeks following the surgery, and she died less than 5 years later. It's thought to be from complications from the procedure. Over the years, Dr. Freeman continued to refine his procedure, always looking for an easier and faster, and ultimately less messy, way to do it. And then he found one. The aforementioned transorbital lobotomy. This is where the ice pick instrument comes into play. It was kind of a brilliant procedure, in a way, because the layer of bone at the back of the eye socket is much thinner than at the top of the skull, which makes it a lot easier to puncture with a sharp implement. It's also a lot closer to the white matter that needs to be severed, and you don't have to go through as much brain tissue. All you had to do was hammer the pick in and then wiggle it around. Literally that. A quick stir of the brain. It doesn't sound incredibly technical or very medical. In fact, it kind of feels a bit hit and miss, and it essentially was. It left no visible scars, however. But its main claim to fame was that it was fast and could be performed in less than 10 minutes. Dr. Freeman actually used this as a way of promoting the procedure. Lobotomies, Quick, easy, no waiting. Kind of like McDonald's. It's only brain surgery after all. For a brief period in history, and I do mean a very brief period, this surgery was extremely popular. Understandable given that the alternatives were straitjackets, cramped cages, spinning chairs, overcrowded hospitals, injured staff members, and neglect on an institutional scale. Then came along this 10-minute procedure that left most patients totally docile, easy to manage, and maybe even happier. Maybe. Providing it all worked, of course. Doctors at the time barely shared the risks, and oversight would not become a thing for decades. Doctors sold it as being more humane. They failed to mention that most would be left in a vegetative state post-procedure. It's a rock and a hard place situation. Some mental health conditions were so severe, the options were lobotomy or asylum. Not a great set of choices, especially given how one was being paddled as a wonder surgery. The problem is that they went way, way further than that. They started giving out lobotomies like it was Halloween treats. They touted them as permanent cures for virtually any mental health condition. People were requesting lobotomies to fix any number of conditions, and they got one. In fact, lobotomies became so popular, with Freeman in such high demand, that he took the procedure out on the road, like some kind of lobotomy rock band tour. He visited hospitals and mental institutions across the United States, doing so in a modified van, which he called the Lobotomobile. I swear I'm not making this up. Across 2 weeks in 1952, he performed 228 lobotomies in West Virginia. He did so for a state-sponsored lobotomy project called Operation Ice Pick. I'll repeat, Operation Ice Pick. It's so on the nose. Freeman himself performed over 4,000 lobotomies during his career. But there were hundreds of other doctors performing this surgery between 1949 and 1952 as well. Over 50,000 lobotomies were performed in the United States during that period, and more than 20,000 in the United Kingdom. And make no mistake, most who underwent the procedure were left in a vegetative state or incapacitated in some way. There were very few success stories regarding the procedure. Dr. Freeman alone was directly responsible for the deaths of more than 100 of his patients. He was eventually banned from performing the procedure. But hundreds of other people died from the surgery too, not just Dr. Freeman's patients. Once again, these were not all violent menaces to society. Many of them were just on the spectrum or experiencing mental health conditions from anxiety or depression to bipolar disorder and a multitude of others. But the plain truth was that many people died from an incredibly high-risk procedure that they certainly didn't need. Dr. Freeman performed the lobotomy on Rosemary Kennedy, which we spoke about earlier in the episode, after meeting her just once. That one meeting was all it took for him to diagnose her with, quote, agitated depression, unquote. Whatever that is. He performed the surgery on the same day. Rosemary's own mother didn't even have time to approve the operation. It just happened. She was just 23 years old. And, believe it or not, the lobotomy actually received the Nobel Prize for Physiology in 1949. And yet, by 1955, just 6 years later, the lobotomy was almost a completely discredited and banned procedure in most countries. So what happened in that six-year period? Well, to put it simply, science. Remember when we said that the alternatives to the lobotomy were arguably much worse? Well, suddenly much better alternatives emerged. The introduction of antipsychotic medication like Thorazine changed the mental health landscape by a massive margin in the 1950s. The medication was non-invasive, and the results were far, far better and more reliable. They weren't permanent like a lobotomy. They were cheap to produce, and they didn't turn people permanently into vegetables for the rest of their lives. They pretty much overnight made lobotomies look savage, primitive, and brutal, because, well, they were. so they fell out of favour with the public. The public also got really savvy to what lobotomies were in that 6 years too. Word spread fast regarding the results. The true horrifying details couldn't be ignored any longer. Dr. Freeman, of course, would stand by his surgery to the bitter end. He continued advocating for lobotomies and conducting them whenever he could for the next decade or so until he was banned from continuing with them. He performed his last lobotomy in 1967 on a woman named Helen Mortensen, who had already had two lobotomies previously conducted by Freeman. This third one would be her last though, because she died of a brain hemorrhage shortly after the surgery. It was this specific incident that got Freeman banned from performing it. I guess this was the limit for the medical community. Not the time in 1951 where one of Dr. Freeman's patients died when he suddenly stopped for a photo during the procedure at Iowa's Cherokee Mental Health Institute. While concentrating on taking a good photograph, the orbitoclast accidentally penetrated too far into the patient's brain and she died almost instantly. It would be crass of me to question why it took more than 100 deaths before they implemented a ban on Freeman, but that quandary, I'm sure, isn't off limits to the families of those who did die. Walter Freeman himself died in 1972. There are some of Freeman's patients still alive to this day, actually, like Howard Dully of Oakland in California. He got a lobotomy from Freeman in 1960 when he was just 12 years old. He told US National Public Radio in 2005 that, quote, "I'll never know what I lost in those 10 minutes with Dr. Freeman and his ice pick. By some miracle, it didn't turn me into a zombie, crush my spirit or kill me, but it did affect me deeply." Walter Freeman's operation was supposed to relieve suffering. In my case, it did just the opposite. Ever since my lobotomy, I felt like a freak, ashamed. Unquote. Dully published a memoir in 2007 about his experience and struggles since his lobotomy. It was a New York Times bestseller. He's now 75 years of age. He has a wife and two adult children. So yeah, there were people who survived it and weren't turned into vegetables. But very few came out unscathed. Lobotomies are now a thing of the past, and mental health has come a long way since the mental health dark ages. Although I think the stigma from back then will take a while to peter out. It's still rampant, even at a time when we know that between 20 to 25% of the population in Western countries experience some kind of mental health issue. That's 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 people. Imagine yourself sat in a busy restaurant. There will be a number of individuals who experience mental health struggles all around you. I watch the news occasionally, and whenever there is a school shooting, high-profile murder, or a public attack of some kind, the media, mainly the American right-leaning media, will often label the criminal as suffering from high levels of mental health problems. This perpetuates the stigma. Criminals must equal mental health issues or insanity, right? Guess what? That's not always the case. Kenneth Bianchi, aka the Hillside Strangler, David Berkowitz, Jeffrey Dahmer, they were all extensively evaluated by several doctors and psychologists, and each were deemed entirely sane. But I guess the public needs a label. Although the real reason is far closer in nature to the understanding that it's far easier for the public to digest that there must be, quote, something wrong with these killers, unquote. There must be something wrong with them than for them to accept that people can do these things and be just like you or me. Although I digress. Brain surgery has come a long way since the 1950s, although there are still surgeries that operate on the same principles of severing the white matter fibers to treat things like extreme epileptic seizures and conditions of that ilk. But these are done on a microsurgical level with extreme precision, caution, and whilst calculating the risk factor in each instance. As you can imagine, the patient is now fully involved in the decision making and informed of all of the data and risk. These days they also use robotic technology rather than ice picks, and the procedures take much longer than 10 minutes. This is for my American friends. The procedure has been entirely outlawed in the United Kingdom since 1983, however. Medications and psychotherapy are now the industry standard course of treatment for most mental illnesses. Though there are still brain stimulation therapies that get down inside the brain, like deep brain stimulation, electroconvulsive therapy, repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, and vagus nerve stimulation. Though these are far less common procedures. We have never been, as a society, more aware and accepting of mental illness than we are today, although we still have a long way to go, and a lot of work to do. Thanks for listening to tonight's episode, guys. Before you go, I just want to let you all know about our Patreon. For every episode we drop for free on your chosen podcast platform, we also drop an episode exclusively on our Patreon page. To access the Patreon episodes costs just $2 a month. That's less than the price of a cup of coffee for double the amount of episodes you'd normally get. That's a hell of an awesome deal, and it helps us out too. My team and I are also planning to release articles, essays, and research exclusively on the Patreon, and also videos from our investigations in the near future. Finally, we will be releasing limited merch items, which will be available through the Patreon at a discount and sooner than general release too. So it's an amazing deal for just $2 a month. So go check it out and get stuck into the episodes that we have already added there. You can join by going to patreon.com/deadsouls. Guys, we hugely appreciate all of your support. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.